you can understand why 28 million Venezuelans who have had claim to this territory going back two centuries and are mired in obscene poverty are kind of asking themselves, wait, why do these 795,000 people, you know, have the right to all this incredibly lucrative oil when we've claimed this territory for just as long?
Hello and welcome to the More Freedom Foundation podcast. If all has gone well, it is now a new year and hopefully everything is gone brilliantly and there will be no politics to talk about because everything has gone peacefully well. But we are going to talk about a potential conflict that may kick off in this year, which is Venezuela and Guyana. I am joined by Robert Morris, our political not expert but intriguer. And I'm Marie McElhone, and I do the podcasty bits.
Yeah, I think, as you mentioned, we're going to be talking about Venezuela and Guyana, and I think I've taken an educated bet here out of the two topics. You know, we recorded these twice in a row. I think that the Yemen Red Sea is vastly more likely to have some kind of development in the next 3 days, where I'm pretty confident we're not going to see open war between Venezuela and Guyana. I could be wrong, been wrong about things before, but I think I'm pretty confident that we're not going to see war. And I think it's, regardless, though, we're going to be diving into history here. So even if, in the unlikely event that there is some large-scale jungle war that the United States is involved in the first week of January, this should still be a useful podcast. So I suppose we should dive into it.
Where would you like to start, at the big history of Guyana or why it is recently in the news?
Well, we should talk about why it is recently in the news, and that is quite simply that Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro is threatening to invade it, is threatening to take the Essequibo region of Guyana, which is most of Guyana.
But it did go to a vote, so you can't argue with democracy.
That's true. The Venezuelans, apparently a whopping 2 million of the Venezuelans went to the polls, and 95%, that's 2 million out of 28 million Venezuelans, and 95% of those, apparently, according to the Venezuelan government, have riotously endorsed the idea that Venezuela should invade Guyana.
Where is Venezuela on the corruption index?
Oh, I'd say pretty high there.
I think countries that are currently in civil wars are ranking higher than it.
Wow. So that's like, yeah, you've actually got a civil war going, but there's less bribery and corruption.
But you have better paperwork.
Oof.
Yes.
Venezuela is not...
So, yeah, I may not totally trust that. Yeah, Venezuela at the moment is doing horrendously badly.
Venezuela is not doing well. I think that we should, of course, point out that the United States has done everything in its power to help Venezuela do worse, but Venezuela is one of those examples. I'm someone who's incredibly sympathetic, usually, when someone cries foul because of U.S. intervention. But wow, Nicolas Maduro and Hugo Chavez before him, there are a lot of U.S. victims who've deserved it less. Let me put it that way.
Well, the big thing you don't want to do is get in the way of American companies and nationalize oil and gas. That is always a great way to get overthrown and your country ruined.
Well, the crazy thing, Rui, is that they're not the first Venezuelans to nationalize oil and gas. They just managed to find a way to do it to provide maximum offense. They managed to do it and be really, really... The United States and those oil companies have, since the 1950s, yeah, back in the 1950s, you tried something like that, and yeah, you were going to quickly find yourself up against a wall with a firing squad. But, you know, in the 70s, they sort of figured out ways around it. The great example would probably be Saudi Arabia, where the oil companies are still finding ways to profit massively, even though nominally it's Saudi Aramco that does all the, that's supposedly taking all the money. And in the 1970s, Venezuela did a large-scale nationalization of its oil and gas industry. But because, insanely, Hugo Chavez decided to do that within the context of, like, we're Cuba too. We've got a Bolivarian revolution going on here. You know, they basically triggered a whole bunch of very atavistic old school instincts in the United States and U.S. oil and gas companies that have led to the crushing of Venezuela's oil industry. And also, it's not just that. They really did manage to also destroy the state oil company, which had, prior to their administration, been seen as one of the best run public oil companies on the planet. Apparently, a lot of Mexico's oil industry renaissance is being run by Venezuelan engineers because they were sort of chased out of Venezuela. The whole Essequibo issue and the fact that we're talking about it now cannot be discussed with any seriousness outside of the context of Venezuelan negotiations with the United States. Because that's what this is really all about. What was so insane about Chavez's whole approach, this is in the first decade of the century. He was initially elected in 1998. I think finally died in 2013. Chavez died and Maduro took power. So Maduro, infinitely less talented than Chavez.
He is a knockoff.
And infinitely less lucky than Chavez in terms of what world oil prices have been doing, has somehow managed to stay there for a decade. If you ask me, it's mostly U.S. aggression that has kept him there. At every turn, when Maduro's manifest failure should have cost him his job, you had Donald Trump or some other likely-looking U.S. imperialist to start shouting about how the Venezuelans had to get rid of him, which quite naturally made a Venezuelan say, wait, why is the United States trying to tell me what to do? Which has been Maduro's salvation over and over and over again. And what he's looking to do here is find out a way to do two things, one of which is his higher priority. His higher priority is to stay in power, but as a lesser priority and as an aid to that, he desperately, desperately, desperately wants the United States to, certainly he'd love the United States to continue investing, to get back to investing in the Venezuelan oil industry, but mostly he just needs to get United States to drop the Trump-era sanctions against Venezuela that forbid any business or country in the world from doing business with Venezuela. And that, I think, is the context within which you have to understand this Guyana thing. I do want to get into the deep history, but I think first it's to look at the timeline a little bit. The key thing to understand about Venezuela over the past 2 years is that geopolitics have teased Venezuela, I think is the right way to put it, have promised Venezuela, aha, finally you're back in the game. Finally, somebody's going to want and need your oil. The United States is going to have no choice but to let you back into the game. And in both of these instances, those promises have been dashed. It just hasn't worked out that way. The first big moment was obviously February of 2022. In February of 2022, I was making hyperventilating shorts saying the United States must reopen relationships with Iran and Venezuela because we need the oil. The world needs the oil. We have to do that now. And what's sort of interesting about what happened is, despite the fact that and instantly the United States started talking seriously about the JCPOA for the last time, the Iran nuclear deal, and started talking to Venezuela. Instantly, the Biden administration was sending real envoys for the first time to Venezuela. What's interesting is that neither of those diplomatic processes came to any fruition, but the Biden administration, basically by just sort of looking the other way, allowed Iran to start selling a lot more oil without interference. This is, of course, it varies by the week. There have also been periods of time over the past 2 years when the Biden administration was straight up hijacking Iranian cargoes. But in the aggregate, the Biden administration allowed Iran to sell a lot more oil to China through Malaysia, through all kinds of like backdoors and this, that, and the other thing. And Maduro is such a clown, is such a mess had destroyed the Venezuelan oil industry to such an extent that he couldn't even benefit from that sort of de facto, hey, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, like, you can sell some out the back door, it'll be fine. But the Venezuelan oil industry was in such ruins that they weren't able to benefit from that.
And the other issue they have is their oil is basically full of sand. It's similar to Canada's oil. So they need a very high price to be profitable, while other countries don't need it quite as much. And I think Saudi Arabia might be one of the lowest because it's such high quality.
And this of course, goes into the fundamental insanity of what Chavez and Maduro were doing, was that I think the majority of the refineries in the world that can handle Venezuelan
tar sands
are in Texas, are in the Gulf.
Yeah.
Chavez was always chewing up the hand that fed him, which seemed okay in the context of the China shock and in the context of historically high prices for oil that we saw in the 2010s and up until 2014 and have not seen since and are unlikely to ever see again. And that's sort of the problem for Venezuela, was that Maduro was like, ah, I've made it through, you know, at least the Democrats don't think they're going to win Florida anymore. So, you know, they're not quite as bad. They need my oil now. And then the oil price just sank and sank and sank and sank and sank.
And the other sort of horrible thing is they have more oil than Saudi Arabia.
In reserves, certainly. But
mm-hmm. Which it's just like you have all this oil and yet you're one of the poorest countries in the world.
It's quite extraordinary, and a quite extraordinary testament to the utter failure of the Bolivarian Revolution. You know, a lot of people want to say, oh, it's just socialism, this is what happens. But actually, the Bolivians also opted hard for socialism in the early 2000s, and that's been an extraordinary success.
And you can also argue the likes of Norway as well.
Well, yes, of course. But in a more local context. So it's not socialism. It is these dumbos.
And also getting on the wrong side of the global superpower.
Yes, it is these dumbos getting on the wrong side of the global superpower. And I mean, Bolivia was on the wrong side of the global superpower. We did a coup in 2019 and we lost because the socialists had brought real benefits to the country. Venezuelans, not great at stuff. So the oil prices came down, continued to come down, and then in October 2023, Israel invaded Gaza and a very serious war between the United States and Iran became and remains a much larger possibility than it had been before. So on October 18th, just 11 days after Hamas's horrific invasion of Israel, the Biden administration already, I mean, clearly there'd been discussions of this and this had been in the works since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But on October 18th, the Biden administration essentially did a deal with Venezuela. Obviously, it's not a real treaty. Neither Democratic nor Republican president. Well, Republican presidents don't try, and Democrats know that they can't get treaties through Congress anymore. But they did a deal, essentially. The Biden administration promised to significantly alter the sanctions. I believe some sanctions have already been lifted. Certain kinds of business and sales are already able to go forward in return for election concessions. There's a Venezuelan election coming up next year, and Maduro essentially just has to concede that he's going to let elements of this election actually
happen. Because that's what I hear the official reason for these American sanctions was, because the last election was so corrupt and illegitimate that America put these sanctions on because they love democracy so much. And if they were to let democracy reign, then America would treat them with respect.
Well, the problem, of course, for Venezuela and what they're going to find in what I believe is largely an inevitable Democratic, better-run future, nobody's really going to want their oil anymore. And that's going to be really, really grim.
Do you know anyone that has oil that the world does really want?
Well, yes. The Guyana, you're reminding me of Guyana, the nominal topic of this conversation. But I was about to get there, I promise you. So on October 18th, this deal was made. And every day since, it's been two solid months since October 18th, you know, in that first, those first days after, oh my gosh, the U.S.
It went close to $100 a barrel.
Yeah, did it? You're right. It got very, very, it quickly spiked. Oh my God, the U.S. and Iran are going to war against each other. And then, you know, the Hezbollah guy comes out and says, we're very angry at Israel, but really, you know, Hamas didn't let us know this was happening. So we're going to, we think Hamas is handling this. It'll be cool. And then, boop, 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 boop. And now the oil price is back in the toilet.
Yeah, today's high was $80, but it has been.
It hit $80.
Yeah, today's high, but it has been in around the 70 US dollars per Brent crude barrel.
You're right. Brent is flirting as of December 21st. Brent is flirting with $80. WTI, the American measure, is back in the low 70s, which we're actually at the point where the Biden administration has committed, because prices are so low, the Biden administration has committed itself to refilling the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So this is bad news for every oil company in the world and every petrostate in the world. And it's especially bad news for Venezuela, which thought in mid-October, okay, we're good. We just got to make some promises.
Prices would stay at 90, maybe 100 again,
yeah,
who knows?
We got to make some promises that we're not going to honor. But now, coming into November, December, the United States government is like, no, we'll continue allow you to sell oil, but you're sticking to those promises. This election next year is going to be kind of real. And the Venezuelan leadership is freaking panicking because they thought, finally, you know, nobody is more married to discredited versions of what the oil market should be than an oil producer is. And Venezuela would be one of them. So they just, at every moment, Maduro's like, finally, it's going to go back to the normal, which was the very, very abnormal of the China shock of the first decade of this century. And it's just not going to happen. So this whole referendum on Essequibo, on taking over, I think, two-thirds of Guyana, that took place on December 3rd, this whole agitation across November and December around taking the territory of its neighbor has primarily been about adding another negotiating position. I think a lot of coverage has emphasized, yes, this is obviously for domestic political purposes. This is so as to get some kind of...
Because Venezuela has claimed this for, what, over 100 years now?
Oh, yes, since the British stole the land, which is absolutely what happened. This is absolutely what happened.
Britain stealing land, I'm sure.
And it is crazy. But the reason that's being brought up is for domestic political purposes to, there are regime, members of the Maduro government who are, you know, saying, oh, the opposition is trying to steal Essequibo from us. You know, he's absolutely using that. But I think what's less emphasized is this is another point in negotiation with the United States. And who's to say it's entirely possible that it's been successful? It does seem like in November there was a lot more pushback against Maduro from the United States against Maduro's failing to meet certain requirements. Now we're all talking about Venezuela and Guyana, and there's an additional element here. And as happy as some elements of the U.S. military would be to go in and have a war with Venezuela right now, I think, you know, the U.S. State Department, the Biden administration is kind of like, we got enough going on right here.
Yes, it's been a busy year.
Yeah, and I think we talked about that briefly in the last episode. On December 14th, Venezuela and Guyana sat down and agreed to disagree on the claims, but agreed to not use force. And when you consider...
Just angry Twitter posts?
Exactly. Continuing angry Twitter posts. Venezuela, apparently, I don't know if they're still moving forward with this, but is attempting to do deals and sell plots of, you know, bundles of prospecting rights to Guyanese territory. I don't think you'd have to be pretty dumb to buy that, but they're trying to move forward with that, you know, accepting bids on territory, this, that, and the other thing. My expectation, the reason that, you know, we're recording this as our second recording today, and I feel confident talking about it until we go forward, is I don't think much more is going to happen here. I think made possibly as a successful gambit by Maduro, he's added another dimension of complexity to this that is making the United States, at least for now, say, maybe we'll talk about the Venezuelan elections when we get a little closer to them or something along those lines, because he's, you know, he's at least committed to not starting a frickin' war in South America. So it's kind of interesting. Let me say at the outset, because I think I'm going to be sounding a little Venezuelan sympathetic over the coming 10-15 minutes. At the outset, the principle is incredibly solid. We simply should not allow countries to invade their neighbors. I have a lot of really confirmed opinions against U.S. intervention. I think that George H.W. Bush did the right thing in 1991, kicking Saddam Hussein out of Iraq. I, of course, think we need to have more thinking and analysis of, wait, did the United States kind of give Saddam Hussein permission to invade Kuwait? We certainly saved him 2 or 3 years prior from Iran, the war he'd started with Iran. We certainly built up his military machine. There's a long-rumored meeting that he had with a U.S. ambassador who he believed gave him the green light to invade Kuwait. All of that is worth investigating and thinking about more seriously. But in the final analysis, this is a guy who invaded his next-door neighbor. In the post-1945 environment, that is not behavior that we allow. I do not like endless comparisons of everybody to Hitler. I think they're ridiculous. But fundamentally, it gets forgotten with the horrific crimes of the Holocaust that we emphasize. But fundamentally, what Hitler did that was wrong at the beginning...
Sudetenland?
Yeah, he invaded his neighbors. And I think, rightly, one of the most redeeming and worthwhile aspects of what the world has decided since 1945 is that you should not do that unless you're the United States, at which point no one can stop you. But generally, like, you should not do that. The United States should not be doing that. And I think it is worthwhile for the United States to stop other countries from doing that. I do, which is fundamentally why, even though we are infinitely more responsible for the war in Ukraine than we were for Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, those conversations sort of end when a country decides to stab its neighbor. And stopping Russia from doing that is worthwhile. I live in mortal terror of large-scale U.S. interventions in South America, Latin America. I think it's a terrible idea. I think that I am terrified that if the Republicans come into power, they will invade Mexico. If Venezuela invaded Guyana, I would absolutely support the United States destroying Venezuela's military. And doing what it felt it had to do. I want to emphasize that before I point out that Venezuela doesn't not have a point here. So is that double negative? Yeah, it was a double negative. But like, Venezuela does kind of have a historical point here that is interesting, but they have no rights to take this country's land. These are long settled borders settled by international arbitration multiple times, most significantly in 1899. I think it is worth pointing out that this is totally, totally an example of imperial theft and is also an example of resource disadvantages that are extreme and created for the benefit of rich world oil companies. The other reason beyond, or the reason why, frankly, the reason why the United States and the broader world might give a crap about Venezuela invading Guyana, I think we always would for the principle, but the reason why Venezuela is even bothering is because Guyana has become famous over the past 3 or 4 years as the possibly one of the last great petroleum boom states. This is a country of just it's about 800,000 people.
Yeah, give or take, 795,000.
795,000 people. They have discovered, I believe it's mostly offshore, but I was having trouble confirming that this morning, extraordinary oil resources to the point where they've been the fastest growing economy in the world for a number of years running. I think Rory, last year they grew to something in the extent of their GDP grew something to the extent of 48% in a single year. It is.
Because they were very poor before that.
Yeah. And this is after a run of extraordinary wealth. And it is kind of, you can understand why 28 million Venezuelans who have had claim to this territory going back two centuries and are mired in obscene poverty are kind of asking themselves, wait, why do these 795,000 people, you know, have the right to all this incredibly lucrative oil when we've claimed this territory for just as long? How is that? You know, you can kind of see that. Also worth pointing out that the territory, I think it's between the Orinoco and Essequibo rivers. If you look, as I'm very fond of doing, at a population density map, nobody lives there.
Yeah.
You know, that is hyperbole, I am sure. There are certainly scattered communities, but a lot of the, it's rare to see on a population density map, vast swaths of a country where the density of person per kilometer is zero. And this is one of those places. You know, Venezuela is not without some basis to what they're saying here. Again, they have no right and no desert of that territory. But they're not wrong, and it does point to a sort of, like, what is the point, really, of Kuwait? What is the point of the United Arab Emirates? What is the point of Qatar? These countries exist because they allowed, initially, the British to deny access to Arab countries, to, you know, the sea and this, that, and the other thing. But they continue to exist with their really almost universally backward governments, forms of government, because it's easier for international oil companies to deal with a country of barely a million or 50,000 rather than a country of 100 million. Like, if those resources were divvied up between the broader Arab world, then you'd have what happens in most of the world, what certainly happened in Europe, I was reading Latin American history recently. What even was happening in the Americas is that smaller, tiny units consolidate into larger units, and that's just a little more rational, that's a little more, can lead to fairer outcomes and broader development. And it's not an accident that Britain and then the United States maintained a lot of the largest oil and gas resources in the Middle East under the control of tiny, little, easily controllable, fundamentally very weak monarchies, with just a few tens of thousands of people that they could make very, 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 very rich in the process of transferring most of the benefit traditional imperial powers at the expense of the vast majority of the Arab population. So looking at Venezuela and Guyana, there's kind of a similar vibe to that, you know?
But also these are countries, quite often they just made up for this very reason.
Indeed, indeed. And if you look at the population of Guyana, it seems more or less half and half, progeny of slaves brought there by the Dutch and the British.
And the natives?
Unfortunately, not a lot of indigenous left. It seems like one of the countries where it was more successfully genocided, or perhaps as dense jungle was never actually particularly heavily populated. I did not look into those details, but it's the progeny of African slaves and Indian indentured workers, not American Indian, but from the Indian subcontinent, brought over by the British after they had more or less abolished slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they abolished slavery and then they replaced it with a form of indentured servitude. Which is not worse, but not as much better as advertised.
Yes, it's still a horrendous situation to be in. I think a lot of, workers in the likes of Qatar from India would be in a form of that today?
Exactly. So Guyana started out as a collection of Dutch colonies over the course of, I believe, actually starting before trading hands. There was in the mid-1700s, I think there was the last of the Anglo-Dutch Wars that were strangely depicted by Ray Dalio and I think Wikipedia as initially a run of Dutch victories, which is a tremendous misunderstanding about what was actually happening there. Before those wars, the Dutch was a not world dominating power, but a world spanning power of great promise. After that, they were, after the Anglo-Dutch Wars of the 1600s, they were manifestly second or third rate powers. And after that final Anglo-Dutch War, it was sort of the British just sort of sweeping up the pieces. But certainly by the end of the Napoleonic Wars, these Dutch territories had been consolidated into British Guiana. And so that's British Guiana, more or less, the exact dates escape me, but sort of say 1814, 15 through 1966 or 1966 or thereabouts, was sort of where they attained independence in 1966. I was reading a New York Times article right before this that I wasn't able to finish, but actually that said that Venezuela might have actually reignited its claims to Essequibo in the 1960s as an anti-communist effort, which I thought was kind of fascinating because British Yemen, one of the only, went from being controlled by the British in 1967 to one of the only, I think the only fully communist state in the Arab, that ever happened in the Arab world. So in the mid-1960s, Venezuela at that point, a good U.S. ally, was concerned that British Guiana might turn commie. So actually relaunched this claim to Essequibo as an anti-communist effort, which is kind of crazy. But just going back to that, at the outset of British Guiana in the 18-teens, it actually stopped at the Essequibo River. So at the beginning, the British had not actually made any real claim to this Essequibo territory that the Venezuelans claimed. It was only in the 1830s or 40s when the British sent some surveyor out there and said, actually, we control all this territory, and just asserted it. And because it was the British versus the Venezuelans, who certainly owed the British a lot of money, because of that, it just wasn't challenged that much. Basically, the British just sent out a surveyor and lopped off a whole bunch of Venezuelan territory. In their defense, it's not clear to me that the Venezuelans were doing much with it either. And it's also not, let's remember that the folks in charge of Venezuela, certainly at that point, were the descendants primarily of Spanish colonists. So who's to say? I mean, actually, probably might actually, thinking about it, might be more just for a country made up primarily of the progeny of slaves and indentured servants, might be a lot more just, actually, for them to be getting all this oil wealth than the progeny of Spanish conquistadors.
Well, there is significantly less, smaller white population in Guyana. I think it's around 0.3% white in Guyana, when I think Venezuela is much higher, 43%.
Fascinating. Yeah. And so I think Guyana is much more of a Caribbean country. Prior to the 1850s, which we're about to get into, it was primarily agricultural, primarily large-scale plantations. When they stopped being able to, when the incredibly small minority of white planters, plantation owners, stopped being able to work those with slaves, they started importing Indians from, India under near-slave-like conditions. And that's where that 0.3% of white folks are. A really classical sort of Caribbean plantation economy until the 1850s, which is sort of the point where, I think honestly in the 1830s and 1840s, the British were like, even by our own standards, this is kind of ridiculous. Like that we really just sent a surveyor out there, lopped off a tremendous swath of Venezuelan territory. And then in the 1850s, they found gold in that territory. Which was the point at which Venezuela lost that territory for all time. I don't know if there's much gold exploitation still going on there, but from that point, the British Empire stopped sort of dilly-dallying about it and was like, no, this is ours, and you are Venezuela, and you owe us a lot of money, and shut up about it. There was some brief hope for Venezuelan claims to Essequibo when the United States started coming on the scene. We love to talk in the United States about the Monroe Doctrine in the 1820s, 1820? It was an 1823, six in my head, but maybe it was as late as the 1830s. No, it was 1823 because John Quincy Adams was Monroe's Secretary of State, I think, who promulgated this. And it's the idea that according to the Monroe Doctrine, the United States in 1823 stood up and said, nobody else is allowed to have access to Latin America. Europe is done. Europe can keep the things it has, but no more Europe in Latin America. And that was, in 1823, completely farcical. There was no possibility of the United States being able to enforce anything like that. What gave it a little, kept it from being remembered as a historical humiliation was the fact that the British were also kind of interested in keeping Europe out of most of Latin America. Over the course of the 19th century, the Monroe Doctrine became more and more of a reality in the Caribbean. So directly in the neighborhood of the United States. Of course, in the 1840s, the United States took Texas, New Mexico, California from Mexico. And in the Caribbean and in Cuba, U.S. influence grew. But I was reading History of Latin America recently, and I think this probably overstates it a little bit, but the author says that in South America, the United States was not the big dog. It was still the British until the 1940s. I think that overstates it a little bit, but the United States, so the Monroe Doctrine wasn't really real. In South America until the 1940s. I think that's a little late, but I would say until World War
One. It got there. Kept at it.
It got there, yes. With, in many cases, quite horrific results. By 1899, Venezuela is, of course, at the top of South America, is kind of, Caribbean adjacent, if you will. I think geographically that's the case. At that point, the United States was beginning to have real influence there. The United States had become the largest economy in the world, and the United Kingdom was beginning to see the writing on the wall and was becoming more and more interested in catering to the United States. So in the 1890s, Venezuela went to the United States and said, gosh, look what the British are doing to us. And the British did the kind of thing I wish the United States did more of today, instead of the, oh, we're just going to, do a mass murder. What the British did was said, well, you know what? You're right. We'll submit to arbitration. And because it was a vastly more racist era than our own, the arbitral panel consisted of two Americans, two people from the United States who would stand up for Venezuela, two people from Britain, and then the presumed indifferent or presumed unbiased Russian, who was going to be the fifth person who would be doing the deciding. The Russians promptly did a backdoor deal, and the United States had to go to Venezuela and say, gee whiz, I'm sorry, but we got you like the mouth of a river. And the arbitral award in 1899, which the British were like, as a concession, were like, of course, let's submit this to arbitration and then control all the details of the arbitration. A technique through which the United States could easily run the entire world at minimal cost. And somehow neglects in favor of extermination projects and the murder of millions. But anyway, I digress. So in 1899, that was sort of the point at which that border got set. And again, Venezuela can make a really great case that they got screwed.
It's a defined country at this point.
It's a border, it's a defined country, and revising that sort of thing is just simply not appropriate.
Also, it may have some physical difficulties. So the Venezuelan army ain't what it used to be.
Yeah, to say the least.
Talk of a lot of desertion. Although it doesn't have a big population to overtake, do you know what are some of the trickiest places to battle in? Some of the trickiest places to fight in are mountains, jungles, deserts, Arctic regions, amphibious landings, and urban areas. And Venezuela may have to do three of those because Guyana is quite mountainous to jungle area, and also it may have to do an amphibious landing to compensate for that. So it may be very difficult. Also, if it wanted to take some of these, say, oil platforms that belong to the Chinese or America or Britain, say, it might get a little bit of kickback.
Yeah, let's say the least. To say the least. I think in Venezuela's favor is, at least on paper, very savvy to point towards desertions and general mismanagement. Yeah, I mean, this is a government that ran the world's best in class state oil company into the ground. It would be strange to expect their military to be in much better shape. But nominally on paper, Venezuela has a military of about 150,000 people. The Guyanan military amounts to about 3,000 people. But the details here, and I think this was first introduced to me in the Costa Rican context, and I think it is actually something I am rather proud of about use of U.S. military power, is that there's been a number of instances. I think you had mentioned earlier that Costa Rica and Nicaragua have issues. Nicaragua has claims to some parts of Costa Rican territory. At some point, if it was the 70s or the 80s, or maybe it was the 60s, the 50s, whatever government of Nicaragua, they've had a run of not very great governments with a lot of encouragement from the United States. Whatever government decided they would win some nationalist points by going to war against Costa Rica, which didn't have a military. And the United States simply flew in a wing of F-16s or whatever it was at that point and landed them in Costa Rica, and Nicaragua shut right the heck up. And I think that's very much the situation with Guyana. Since Maduro renewed these threats, sort of over the past month or so, the U.S. military has been very straightforward about, we are stepping up our cooperation with the GDF, the Guyanese Defense Forces. I believe there have been U.S. Military platforms distributed around Guyana. I mean, there's no real question. This is Maduro is looking for domestic political points, looking for points in his ongoing negotiations with the United States. He is an idiot. He's very bad at government. He's very bad at a number of things.
But he's still alive, so that's worth something.
Exactly. And I think that an actual invasion of Guyana is a context in which he would not be alive.
But it's the speed that Guyana is growing at is outstanding. It's 62%. It grew last year, its GDP.
Oh, that's extraordinary.
It's possible it could reach 100%. Like, because it's such a small country with so much oil, and all these companies from all around the world are just pouring money into it. Like, it could, you know, its military could be like some sort of bizarre cyberpunk thing. With drones and, you know, considering it's so small, it might invest in like the top gear and all these oil companies. So it's, you know, who knows what will happen? Like, they could arm themselves to the teeth with this threat in a small amount of time.
Well, that's an interesting, really interesting question that came up in a science fiction book I've been reading recently, which is, how do you police and guard territory where really nobody lives? If the Venezuelan military were trying to, you know, push tanks and you know, the resources you need to plant a flag somewhere in Guyana, or start up large scale or take over large scale resource exploitation facilities, like as you said, the cyberpunk, a number of drones. Could have tremendous damage to the point where it'd almost be disappointing to the U.S. government. Like, no, we wanted to use our F-35s. And like, sorry, we destroyed the entire Venezuelan military with the contents of a Best Buy. Best Buy is a electronics retailer in the United States.
I think also, well, one headline that made me laugh was a Venezuelan patrol boat got sunk because it accidentally rammed a cruise liner that had a reinforced hull. It was trying to sort of go up alongside it. I think it wanted to threaten it in some fashion, but instead got in front of it, and then the cruise liner sank it. I think that was maybe 2014.
Yeah, it's important to remember that there's real suffering to the Venezuelan people, but man, Chavez and Maduro, like, it's funny stuff. It's just their complete incapacity. And I mean, they're clowns. They're clowns. And they have they've really damaged their country. It is interesting. I've been reading a lot of Latin American history recently. I'm trying to put together a video on Venezuela and Argentina. I'm wondering if I ever will. But it is just worth pointing out that Venezuela has never really had a period of good government. They lucked out with the oil, obviously, and this allowed them to weather the 1970s fairly well. Most developing countries in the world suffered mightily during the 1970s. Any non large-scale oil producing country in the world suffered mightily in the 1970s, including some that did. The United States was still producing a lot of oil and still went through a really bad decade because of the oil crisis. Venezuela did better and actually allowed a sort of one of the more successful democratic processes that it had ever had to continue. I think it's 1958. They had the Punto Fijo Pact or something, which is essentially like an agreement of a kind of democratic oligarchy. Essentially, a bunch of parties got together and agreed to sort of share patronage and alternate some political offices in the name of not letting the military take over again, which I think is a worthy goal, and is somewhat functional. But I think there's a lot of really rosy hindsight about this period of quasi-democratic success. I think it's kind of exaggerated just how successful it was. I think it's important to remember that even with the massive oil wealth that Venezuela had been benefiting from, it was a founding member of OPEC in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s. Even with all of that, people were miserable enough to choose Hugo Chavez democratically. Hugo Chavez, who was a convicted coup plotter, he tried to take power violently in 1992, and things were bad enough that in 1998, the Venezuelan people, I think it might have been a majority, I don't know exactly how elections worked at that point, but enough of the Venezuelan people chose the coup plotter over the guys who had supposedly been maintaining a functional democracy for the past, 35 years or so, or 40 years, more or less exactly 40 years. So horrifically, the Chavez-Maduro era actually has a kind of stability for Venezuela that it never really had. It's a great tragedy. You know, it was the home of Bolivar, Simon Bolivar, the great liberator. Venezuelan history does not make happy reading. I definitely think it's time for Maduro to go, but I don't have particularly high hopes for what follows, frankly.
So is the next year potentially going to be better for Venezuela if it gets these sanctions eased somewhat?
Absolutely. I think Maduro is a clown. I think that the whole Chavista revolution has been a great misstep, but there's no question in my mind that Venezuela would be infinitely better off without these U.S. sanctions, that these U.S. sanctions have made everything worse and have actually prolonged Maduro's time in power. They've given him an excuse. His incredible failure would be much, much more apparent if the Trump administration hadn't decided to give him this massive excuse. He's like, no, it's the capitalists. No, it's evil Donald Trump, which fair description, who's done this to you. It's not me. I think it's for humanity, for the stability of the region. We absolutely must just back off. Our treat, it's the only serious, semi-serious, which is very little that's serious about Nicaragua or Venezuela, or the governments, the consequences are serious. But the only, semi-serious committed left-wing dictators or wannabe dictators or dictatorships in Latin America are the places that the United States has targeted the most. Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba. We know that the process of aggression, coups, picking a new president, a new fake president the way Donald Trump did for Venezuela.
Yeah, but you can't let the country decide for itself. America knows these things better.
Right. You know, and if they decided for themselves, they'd do terrible things like elect a guy who's more pro-American than the Republican Party in Argentina. It's pretty extraordinary. But again, it's just like the only places where like vicious, committed anti-U.S. dictatorships exist are the places where the United States has spent the most resources being the most aggressively against them. Cuba, obviously, we've had this embargo forever. Venezuela, I'm something we're wrestling with right now is the degree to which the United States may or may not have been responsible for a 2002 coup against Chavez that really accelerated the nature of that regime. There's no question that we've been trying to do regime change against Maduro for almost the entirety of his time in power. We picked a fake president and got most of our allies to endorse him, which is still just such an absurdly comic thing that we tried to do there. And in Nicaragua, we launched a horrific civil war there in the 1980s. And the result is that Daniel Ortega, after finally giving up power, was elected back into power. You know, and he's proved to be, I haven't done deep studies, but I do believe that Daniel Ortega, certainly in this incarnation, has proved to be quite damaging and quite awful, which I don't necessarily believe was the case in the 1980s when we were trying to kill him so badly. But it's the places with the worst anti-American places. Governments are the places where we've done the most work to try to overthrow them. It's clearly time for a step back and a different approach. Like, the approach to Argentina and Chile. Like, it's not really emphasized so much. Argentina and Chile have a better reasons to be angry at the United States than, most countries in the world. In 1973, we overthrew Salvador Allende and put the Pinochet in power. We may not have been as directly involved, but certainly were a massive supporter of the Argentine junta that was in charge from, I want to say, they were actually already becoming more and more in power under the Perón's last wife. But from 1976 to 1983, really horrific military junta ran Argentina, killed tens of thousands, at least 10, 15, 20,000 people. Similar deal in Chile, like just straight up disappearances and executions of leftists. This isn't like ongoing. There are a little bit of ongoing guerrilla battles, but mostly just like knock on the door in the middle of the night, like horrifying Gestapo stuff, completely U.S. supported. In recent decades, we've just sort of backed off. You know, we just sort of don't, you know, we don't bother with them anymore. They're far enough away. I think there's probably a racist element to this. They're countries that tend to be run by people who look a little whiter.
Yeah, predominantly white.
Yeah, but we just don't do that sort of thing anymore. And Argentina just invited, just reelected a libertarian crackpot who's like more pro-Israel than Joe Biden and wants the dollar and wants to, he practically, he's going to take an oath behind, wrapped in an American flag or something. I mean, it's ridiculous. And in Chile, it was a big thing. They were going to revise the constitution. They were going to throw out Pinochet's constitution, and they elected this charismatic young leftist. And if we wanted to make that charismatic young leftist a dictator for life, we could have done what we did to Maduro, and come with a full press. The charismatic leftist is sinking or swimming on his own rights, and it seems in recent weeks that Chile is, after trying a left-wing version and then trying a right-wing version, are just like, we're probably just going to stick with the constitution we have, which is very friendly to U.S. business interests. It's just, if we just back off.
Can you see America doing that in 2024?
It'd be so easy. But we won't.
Yes.
Obama tried to, and Biden just has not. The Venezuela, Biden has tried to. Obama wasn't friendly to Venezuela, but Trump was really, really, really aggressive to Venezuela.
Yeah, very hostile.
And Biden has barely backed off, has flirted with the idea of backing off a little bit from this really, really hostile regime of secondary sanctions, which is usually reserved for countries that we have deemed supporters of terrorism, which we may have made somehow put Venezuela in that category as well, as we have Cuba, which is ridiculous, at least when you're talking post the 1970s. Cuba, Obama really inspired. One of the few great things Obama did was do a huge opening to Cuba, which Trump completely reversed, and Biden has done nothing to really stray from the Trump policy at all, which is horrific in my mind. Nicaragua, I need to dive in a little bit more on Nicaragua. I know that we're sort of continuing to maintain pressure and sanctions. I don't know exactly the nature of those. And we should probably just quit it, you know?
Okay.
So, I don't know. But yeah.
So unlikely to have a new conflict, which is good to hear.
That's my hope. but we'll see. We could very well, you know, maybe we'll be.
Yeah,
maybe
sometimes
we'll...
people do incredibly stupid things.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would be dreadful if they got beaten by a country of less than a million people.
Well, they wouldn't be beaten by a country of less than a million people. They'd be beaten by the United States. I think it's a very likely result.
Well, we hope you have a wonderful new year, and thank you very much for listening.
Indeed. Toodles.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire: What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.